Hi again and welcome back to episode 2 of Kulturdenken, Thinking Culture, the podcast of the International Research Center for Cultural Studies at the University of Art and Design in Linz. We are in Vienna at the symposium titled OLFAC, Sensing Across the Humanities, Science and Arts. Brandon Wolf is an interdisciplinary theater artist and clinical associate professor of English at New York University. Both his scholarship and performance practice work to facilitate connections and collaborations between artists, academics, and activists. Concurrent with his scholarship, Brandon's artistic work investigates performance's potential as a social practice. Deodorizing das K-Wort. In his presentation at the OLFAC Symposium, Brandon makes the audience eat garlic and exhale the fresh garlic breath directly into each other's faces.
Please, come, please. Come all the way forward. I'm cutting enough because I'm going to be distributing this in a second. Let's just get a few. That's one varietal. Let me get the other varietal. Oh, yeah. So we have music and red Romanian. Probably be enough, yeah. A little more. Just one more clove. How many of us are in here? About 30 people? Yeah? Okay, good. I hope everybody's hungry. Cool. Let's chop this up.
We have specific pain receptors in the body, and they turn out to be uniquely sensitive to garlic. Garlic, the way it's designed, it initiates a pain response, at least in humans, but probably in a variety of other mammals. Now, that doesn't mean that all pain is bad. You can have pleasurable pain. And that is certainly true for garlic. It can be unpleasant if you overdo it. But certainly at a low level, it is pleasant. Eric Bloch, the world's most renowned garlic scientist, emeritus.
If you're passing it around, we'd love you to smell it, but also taste it. Pop it right in your mouth. We need your garlic breath. Can I smell somebody's breath? You need another one. Fill the room. Fill the room. Come on. Yeah, yeah, come on. Let's really let it circulate. You can smell yourself already. Now, maybe if you want to be a little bit braver, turn toward your neighbor and smell their breath.
Now, if this is something you don't want to do, Brandon says you are not alone. Everyone has a story when someone else's breath overwhelmed them or when someone else's cooking smell got too much for them. This is how Brandon's research on garlic got started. Here is Brandon.
So I lived in Germany for many years, in Berlin. And I found it extremely strange that I started to notice more and more a kind of, let's call it, German allergy to garlic. I lived in a WG in a shared flat with a guy who is still one of my closest friends. And I was the cook in the shared flat. And I was really surprised. You know, one evening he came to me and said, hey, tomorrow I have a really important meeting with my chef, with my boss. Would you mind not putting any garlic in the cuisine tonight? I thought to myself, what? You know, he said, yeah, you know, I don't want to smell like garlic tomorrow. That could be offensive. And then slowly I started to notice this more and more where, you know, you would say, oh, friends are going out on a date. And then they make a comment like, oh, well, the person ate knoblauch, ate garlic at the date. And I didn't want to order something with garlic. We couldn't make out. Right. Or somebody would say, oh, there's too much garlic in this. I can't eat it. Right. And
so you weren't familiar with that?
No, at all. This is totally not from my cultural background. And in fact, when my roommate said this to me, I thought it was a joke. So I just put garlic in the tomato sauce anyway, right? Later, I used to joke with him. I was like, oh, I didn't know it was an anti-fascist gesture at that point. And why? Because I got obsessed with this weird, in a very sort of German context, because that's where I was living at the time, what is going on here? And so I started investigating it, and it turns out that this allergy goes back to the Middle Ages. And I mean, by allergy, I mean a kind of Knoblauchhass, like a hate of the garlic smell. And that garlic was in the Middle Ages in Germany a metonym for the Jew, the sort of dirty Eastern European Jew who smelled like garlic. And then I started stumbling on etchings and drawings from the Middle Ages with like – a sort of hook-nosed, stereotypical Jewish caricature with a money bag in one hand and a garlic clove in the other hand, piggy banks that look like this, beer songs from the 19th century in praise of garlic, das Knoblauch-Ehrenlied, right, which was just filled with Jewish stereotypes, and that this also became internalized by Jews who wanted to whitewash, who wanted to sort of integrate into like white Aryan Teutonic society in the 19th century. So this led us to discover all of these documents, including one that that was in the performance lecture tonight, of the first ethnic rhinoplasty, nose job. So that, you know, an ostensibly Jewish patient with this large nose is feeling depressed and conspicuous or visible in the society and comes to this doctor not because he has some medical condition, but because he's feeling melancholic. And he asked the doctor to cure his melancholia, right? So in this moment that like Jews start in late 19th century, starting to ban garlic from their diets to kind of integrate into bourgeois sort of white society, they also start cutting their noses off.
Vienna, 1898, a medical theater.
Sehr geehrte Anwesende, I take the liberty of presenting a new method of rhinoplasty. While the general purpose of rhinoplasty is to cover nasal defects to eliminate the effect of injuries and especially pathologic conditions, I was recently confronted with the task of transforming a perfectly healthy, but due to its size and shape, conspicuous nose into an inconspicuous nose. Briefly, the case was as follows. The end of January this year, a 28-year-old landowner, can you sit up straight to look like a landowner, please? Thank you. Like a real bonza. You know, just sit up. A 28-year-old landowner appeared in my office. He related that his nose was the source of considerable annoyance. Wherever he went, everybody stared at him. Often he was the target of remarks or ridiculing gestures. On account of this, he became melancholic, withdrew almost completely from social life, and had the earnest desire to be relieved of his deformity. Should we relieve him? Come, okay, Silke, this is where I need your help. Okay, it's okay. So sit back. It's going to be okay. It's going to be just put your head back a little bit. Okay, great. And now we need to just stick the mic right in here. Can we turn it up a little bit, please? Okay, I promise this isn't going to hurt. Wait, hang on one sec. We need a cup.
I am not worried.
Don't be worried. It's going to be okay. Not right against it, just a little away so I can get my fingers there. You ready? Here we go. Okay?
I'm brilliant.
You're looking great. Hang on one second.
Wonderful.
You can sit down, but you stay there. Show everyone your beautiful nose. Wonderful. Danke, medical assistant. Really appreciate it. He was in a deep psychic depression, and I was convinced that the patient could not be helped otherwise but by a surgical reduction of his nose. After the operation, the depressed attitude of the patient subsided completely. He's happy to move around unnoticed. His happiness in life has increased, his wife is glad to report. It would have been an extraordinary pleasure for me to present the patient himself today. Unfortunately, he could not be persuaded. It went in a few different directions. One was, in addition to these sort of very, very culturally specific Jewish-German history, we started to investigate, well, is this a phenomenon elsewhere, right? Or is this really limited to this sort of bizarre German situation, right? And it turns out in lots of contexts historically, you know, has garlic been used as a sort of means of creating an other? Italians and Greeks and Turkish guest workers in Germany after the war, and now sort of Arab migrants, right, or people with migration background in Europe, but also at the turn of the 20th century, you know, in occupied Korea, right, like the Japanese were super sensitive, right, and targeted Koreans as Knoblauchfresser, you know, garlic eaters. Or in the Indian context, like the high class Brahmins thought of garlic as sort of stinky and smelly for the lower classes, right? So we started to get fascinated that garlic is a kind of trans-historical, trans-cultural phenomenon as a means of creating others, and that it had been weaponized in a whole number of different historical and ethnic contexts.
It's interesting because if you say you weren't aware of the fear of garlic, were you aware of the smell, or did you think it was something
delicious,
discomforting?
Totally delicious.
Not even being transformed and exhaled.
It never occurred to me that that there could be any kind of ethnic mapping onto it, or that like anyone would care. Like there's so many other smells, you know, that one could talk about, right? And so I was like, what is this thing with the garlic? You know, what do you mean you don't want to smell like garlic in front of your boss? What could that possibly mean? You know, maybe you want to shower, you know, like there are all kinds of other sort of social norms, right, that one thinks about. But there was something about the garlic that just like it really threw me off. And then I was fascinated that this wasn't a merely German phenomenon, but that there was something about this particular plant that has inspired all of this weaponization, right, and this sort of creation of the other.
Why do you think it is that universal? Do you think it's probably the transformation process that's uncontrollable?
What we learned from Eric Bloch, the garlic scientist, is that it does have, like allicin has a particular chemistry, right? Other alliums have it as well, you know, but that the molecule of allicin that creates that stink, which is actually the plant's defense mechanism, put a garlic clove on your skin, it'll burn you. And so the way that molecule works, it penetrates the membranes of the skin in ways that other molecules don't. And so when humans eat it, it gets into the bloodstream, right, and comes out and then goes everywhere in the body, right? You know, so there is something about when you eat garlic, it comes out of your pores and does produce a smell. So I wonder if there's just something interesting about the chemistry of this particular allium that does something to humans that then had all of this meaning coded onto it over time, right, in different cultural contexts. You know, it still seems to me just like tell people about this project. They go, what? What do you mean that this is the case with garlic? I had no idea, right? You know, I never thought about that it could have this sort of larger meaning, right? Or that it could be used as a kind of weapon or tool to make another.
I also don't think it's only the smell or the transformed smell. I think it's also, well, I don't know, probably also just the fun of eating it. Yeah. It's cheap. It's delicious.
Yeah, but I wonder why it's such a threat. I mean, in the German context, we can surmise that you have all of these Eastern European migrating Jews in the Middle Ages, right, who have no money, right? And what do they have? They have onions and garlic, right? And so there's fear in the society about these migrating others, just like the guest workers. And they go, oh, they have a particular smell. They have a particular stench. It's the garlic stench, right? You know, diesen Knoblauchfresser. These are the savages that eat the garlic. You know, but what comes first? Was the German cuisine already super bland, right? You know, or is it made bland as a means of not wanting to be spicy or different or, you know, cause upset in your system? You know, I don't know.
Do you know if garlic was imported to Germany or was it always here?
That's a great question. I don't know. There was a moment where we were trying to map the sort of origin roots of how it got here. And it's hard to do. There's a few books that map it back to the sort of mountains of Afghanistan, like pre-humans, right? And then it's on the spice trade. And I don't know if it's the sort of Eastern European Jews that end up in Germany in the Middle Ages or if it was here already. I don't know. I haven't been able to find that out.
In his presentation, Brandon refers to how recent garlic cases in the U.S. have been sentenced.
In Rhinebeck, New York, which is upstate New York from where I come from Brooklyn, just last year, a persistent neighbor with quote-unquote olfactory sensitivities complained so much about the smell of garlic coming from the Thai restaurant next door to her apartment that the city closed the restaurant down. And the civic ordinance in New York State used to deodorize the neighborhood reads as follows. Section 24.141, emission of odorous air contaminants. No person shall cause or permit the emission of an odorous air contaminant or steam or water vapor if the air contaminant or steam or water vapor causes or may cause detriment to the health, safety, welfare, or comfort of any person. A similar thing happened in Portland, Oregon, on the west coast of the United States not too long ago as well, where city code 8.36.040, noisome odors or vapors, reads as follows. No person shall burn upon any premise or in any street, alley, or other place any animal or vegetable substance which shall create an offensive or noxious odor. How's your garlic breath? You tasting it? Yeah, is it working way through your system? Can everyone give like a big exhale? You think there's a similar ordinance here in Wien? I wonder. I know there's one in Berlin, right? You know, garlic odors in the neighborhood can get in major trouble. Okay, but what jumps out at me here, right, in this first ordinance from New York State, is the word comfort. Where I'm from in New York City, I see uncomfortable people fleeing subway cars all the time to get away from someone's odor. I've done it. My 6.5-year-old daughter, Talia, we get into the subway and she goes, Daddy, it stinks in here. Can we go to the other car? Have you done it? In the U-Bahn, in the BIM, on the bus? Even if you've spent, like many of us in this room, some of you or much of your professional life thinking and writing about these questions, did you notice the last time someone's odor made you uncomfortable? Made you do something? What did you do?
This is crucial because here Brandon is asking why and how we other and exclude people because of their smell. What cultural norms are we following here? Where does the othering come from? What are good and bad smells for us? In his presentation, Brandon quotes a footnote in Freud's Das Unbehagen in der Kultur, where Freud discusses his theory that the olfactory became shameful when we started to walk erect.
An der Tatsache des Interurinas et Faeces nascimur nehmen alle Neurotiker und viele außer ihnen Anstoß. Die Genitalien erzeugen auch starke Geruchsempfindungen, die vielen Menschen unerträglich sind und ihnen den Sexualverkehr verleiden. So ergebe sich als tiefste Wurzel der mit der Kultur fortschreitenden Sexualverdrängung die organische Abwehr der mit dem aufrechten Gang gewonnenen neuen Lebensform gegen die frühere animalische Existenz. Sigmund Freud.
We're going to get a little bit deeper into this now. Isn't it interesting that our varied attempts to be less conspicuous, especially in turn of the last century Vienna, meet at the nose? The thing we smell with and the way we smell. Those of us looking to fit in, to integrate, and to be recognized as model bourgeois citizens started taking off our noses just as we eliminated strong odors like garlic from our cuisines and our cultural consciousnesses. Now, has anyone reread Das Unbehagen in der Kultur, Civilization and its Discontents, recently? Yeah. I was flipping through it more or less by accident some months ago, and I was surprised and delighted to find that Freud has this wonderfully provocative and stinky footnote in Chapter 4 about the repression of olfactory stimuli. So basically, in case you don't remember, it goes a little bit like this. He makes the argument that the whole process of so-called civilization comes at the expense of olfaction. As quadrupeds, we were much more reliant on smell for sexual attraction, and our noses were sort of at the same height as our genitals, so it's hard to miss, you know, when it's right there in front of your face. But as soon as we went erect and started walking on 2 feet, our genitals were plain to see but harder to smell. And this is how arousal, this is Freud's theory anyway, shifted predominantly to visual cues instead of olfactory ones. Our privates became public and publicly visible, and we felt embarrassed for the first time about body odor, about our genitals, and about our excretions as we realized that we were naked, dirty, and smelly. Thus emerges the cultural idea of cleanliness, of bodily hygiene and social taboos against strong smells of bodily fluid. Civilization should be deodorized, but now that we're civilized, we're also deeply repressed because I try to get my kids into every one of these presentations. Just like my 2-year-old son, we're all still totally anally fixated. So, for Freud at least, the widespread discontent of sexual repression might be better understood as a kind of cosmic revenge of the nose.
Brandon, thinking about the question how much he himself is othering people for their smell, started making olfactory art.
So that was sort of one thing we started to investigate. Then we started to think to ourselves, well, how does it work? Right. You know, and I was always interested in why smell and taste are kind of forgotten aesthetic categories at the theater. Right. And of course, there are long histories in the history of performance art. Right. And Barbara Kirschenbach-Gimlet, who's a performance studies scholar, has done some really interesting work, a kind of remapping of theater history via taste and smell. Right. But in mainstream theater, like other than Romeo Castellucci, Florentina Holzinger and some others, smell and taste aren't really sort of it remains a kind of visual and oral medium, Of course, there's histories of performance art, you know, that go back to medieval feasts, but also, you know, the early 20th century avant-garde, you know, but I was really interested in like, well, oh, we're investigating smell. Might this be an opportunity to think about the use of smell and taste at the theater? So then we started thinking about, well, how does smell work? How does olfaction work? What's the science of olfaction? What is the science? How does garlic actually work? Why does it stink? And so we started interviewing garlic farmers and garlic scientists and Eric Bloch, who I mentioned tonight, you know, who spent his entire career trying to understand the chemistry of the allicin molecule, which is the molecule that gets created when garlic is chopped or crushed. And it functions in all kinds of interesting ways. But what we realized was even as we did that, even we tried to rescue the garlic from its misappropriation historically by different cultures, we were still mapping all kinds of meaning onto it. And we started asking ourselves, what might the garlic want? And so this was the sort of a next phase where we started saying, well, can we listen to it more deeply? How does it take light? How does it take water? What is the science of that? And what does it actually want as a plant? What do plants want? So we started thinking to ourselves like, oh, well, what if we planted the garlic everywhere? You know, might this be a way of asking in performance our human colleagues to take the more than human world seriously in a different kind of way? Might this be a playful way of thinking about, well, we mapped all this meaning onto garlic, and what if we sort of remap our relationship to the olfactory, right? What if we planted garlic everywhere? How might we sort of remap our olfactory sensorium, and what might that do to our relationship to space, to one another, to the more than human or the plant world? How would that change the way we engage in daily life, the way we walk through the street? If I plant garlic here and I'm committed to it and I have to return to it, it's going to change the way I go to work. It's going to change the way I walk through the city. It's going to change my relationship to how I engage with nature. And so, of course, this is all quite consciously a kind of utopian gesture. But we started to get interested in, well, what if we actually tried it? So we started holding these planting workshops where we would literally teach people how to plant and start literally saying, hey, go plant and send us coordinates and let's remap the city. Let's see what that does to one another. It does happen to be illegal in New York. I did some in Vienna yesterday right in front of the Freud House. I have no idea if it's illegal here. The police drove by and looked at me oddly, but they didn't stop. But I think it was also this question of to say – of course, we're all exposed to different levels of precarity when it comes to the police, you know, and in the U.S. right now, this is a very challenging issue. There are certain communities that are really exposed to ICE, communities of color that have a level of exposure that I don't have, right? So I think there's and this question came up in the presentation tonight. What are the ethics of asking people to go out and break the law? But there was also this sort of question to one another to say, hey, well, you know, if we're willing to go plant garlic everywhere and sort of change our relationship to the city, is that also an invitation to question our relationship to authority and what else might we want to do afterwards? And how might it promote alternative networks of solidarity, you know, not only against the cops, but against the bigots, right? So tonight in the performance, I asked everyone to sit next to each other and literally put their nose in one another's mouths after they'd eaten all this garlic, right? You know, and you could see people sort of disgust, discomfort. The narrative I was trying to trace there was, okay, well, this just happened in real time. It's super harmless what's happening here. We're in this privileged setting, you know, but how different is this from when you get onto the U-Bahn or the subway or the BIM, right? And there's somebody there, you run away from their smell. Is there an opportunity through this performant event to rehearse new modes of being social in the world, doing things differently, or at least thinking about like what you've done unconsciously in the past? Like, oh, well, what if I do like smell this stinky person neighbor next to me in this performance context, right? Like, and I do have the guts to like smell the stink of the garlic from this person's breath. Does that toggle something in me about some prejudices that I have about bad smelling, right? You know, bad smelling individuals, or why smell has been sort of banished from society, or why we think about sort of cleanliness and neutral smelling as the way to be in the world. That's all highly politicized, right? And there's a history of like what it means to sort of assume a set of bourgeois norms, right, as a sort of de-smellified society. And if we embrace, or if the theater sort of stages an opportunity to be interested in and investigate smell, right, and the sort of the stink of the garlic, might that open up kinds of pathways as we evaluate our own sort of past behaviors and prejudices, And might it be an invitation to think about doing something differently next time?
This was the second episode of Kulturdenken at the Eufach Symposium at the International Research Center for Cultural Studies in Vienna. Thank you, Brandon Wolf, and thank you for listening.